This week on Making Contact.
This is the first time the well has ever gone dry.
I wouldn't want to eat fish that came out of this river right now.
Fresh water is our most essential natural resource. Yet worldwide, more than 1 billion people don't have access to clean, safe drinking water. And it's a sure bet that as water scarcity grows, so too will this alarming statistic. So how can we protect our freshwater resources? And where do we start? On this edition, from a grassroots toxic canal cleanup to a long-standing watershed war, we'll hear from U.S. water stewards across the country, people working to protect and restore our valuable fresh waterways and keep water resources part of a shared global commons. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, bottle ideas, and important information. Rivers offer some of life's small pleasures, but these valued resources and sanctuaries are facing troubled times. Drought, toxic waste, and development are mainly to blame. The Tuolumne River in California, which begins 13,000 miles high in the majestic peaks of Yosemite National Forest, is no exception. For years, it's been extensively tapped to deliver water to the San Francisco Bay Area and California's Central Valley. So in 1981, a group of rafters and kayakers formed the Tuolumne River Trust.
Hi, I'm Patrick Koppel. I'm the Deputy Executive Director with the Tuolumne River Trust. We're here in LaGrange, California, on the banks of the Tuolumne River. And this site is basically where the river transitions from the Sierra Nevada out to the Central Valley, which, as you can see, it's a big change from more mountainous terrain to more flat and agricultural land. So what we're trying to do here in the Central Valley in particular is create a river system that is able to continue to support fish and wildlife that are native to this river and depend on this river. So Chinook salmon are kind of an iconic fish species that return every fall to the Tuolumne River. River otters and beavers and fox and bald eagles and osprey and all kinds of great animals live along the Tuolumne River. People sometimes have a hard time conceptualizing where the Tuolumne River starts and where it ends and how everything is tied together. Up in the Sierra Nevada, the Tuolumne starts in Yosemite National Park on the slopes of Mount Dana and Mount Lyell. And it flows, draining the northern half of Yosemite National Park through Tuolumne Meadows and down to the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. And so in an average year, about 1.9 million acre-feet of water is produced by the Tuolumne River watershed. Maybe 16% or so is reserved for fish and wildlife. So moving downstream, we'll come to the Don Pedro Reservoir, which is the largest reservoir on the Tuolumne, formed by Don Pedro Dam. And this dam provides water for 200,000 acres or so of farmland in Stanislaus County. It clearly provides benefit for folks in the Central Valley, as does Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. It provides drinking water for over a million people in the Bay Area. Moving downstream from there, we come to the Central Valley. As you can see, the Central Valley is, you know, a huge agricultural area, and agriculture is one of the biggest economic drivers of this region. And so folks may think that we're trying to take their water away from them. But what we're trying to do actually is ensure a healthy, vibrant agricultural economy while at the same time ensuring a healthy and vibrant river ecosystem. We have a whole variety of approaches to protecting the river. Of course, we try to teach people about the river and teach about its importance. But we also do work with cities and counties and irrigation districts to ensure that they're using the water wisely, that they're not wasting it, that they're using it efficiently, as efficiently as possible. We actually bring classrooms of fourth graders out to the river to teach them about the ecology and the water quality, but also, you know, where their water comes from and why it's important to protect our river. And we've had several thousand students go through this program over the past 3 years or so. So if we can work with students at younger ages, you know, they're going to be our future river stewards. They're going to be the ones that are taking care of the river in the future for the next generation. And those kids will also take that information home to their families and talk to their parents about it, and it'll trickle upwards as well. So here in California, it's important for us to ensure that we don't log that last tree or dam that last river, because the rivers provide so much for us in terms of economic resources, but also in terms of recreational and spiritual resources as well.
A common misconception is that global freshwater supplies are endless. They're not. Although 70% of the Earth is covered by water, less than 1% is available for human consumption. Put another way, if you could fit all the world's water into a 1-gallon jug, the amount of available freshwater would equal just about a tablespoon. As a global community, we're all faced with an unquestionable fact of life. We have to protect our fresh waterways. The Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn, New York is one of those waterways. It's one of the most polluted bodies of water in the country, and traditionally, most New Yorkers try to ignore it. But a group of Brooklynites has launched a grassroots effort to change that. Correspondent Samara Freemark has the story.
The Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn, New York, isn't really the kind of place you'd think people would hang out. The canal runs from South Brooklyn into the New York Harbor. It makes its way through a mix of neighborhoods. Immigrants live along the Gowanus, and so do hipsters and yuppies. And there are plenty of developers who want to build condos along the canal. They envision a Venice of the New World. But for now, the canal is dirty. Really, really dirty.
You never know what you're going to get when you come out here. There are days when it actually kind of passes for something that you can at least pretend is clean. But there are days when it's just, like, absolutely coated.
That's Alex Kovaleski. She's standing with me on a makeshift pier next to the Gowanus. We're looking into the water, watching trash float by. She says that in the bottles and the plastic bags and the scraps of paper that pass, she can see centuries of bad waste management decisions.
Runoff from the city is always poured almost directly into the waters. Cities have always been built by waterways, and the waters have always been where all the refuse has basically been dumped.
Kovaleski is a Gowanus dredger, a member of a group of Brooklynites who organize cleanups of the area and canoe trips on the canal. They do it for fun, and they also do it to raise awareness of just how dirty the canal is. They're trying to get people to see that the Gowanus is worth saving, and they hope that getting people to use the canal for recreation will win them some cleanup funding under the Clean Water Act. Kovaleski has been a dredger for about 3 years.
I was looking for a practical way to, be an environmentalist. I mean, the goal was to clean up the whole ocean and the whole earth, but I didn't want to be overwhelmed and catatonic, and this is exactly what I was looking for.
The Gowanus Dredgers Canoe Club was founded with the primary purpose of cleaning the waterway.
That's Owen Foote. He's one of the leaders of the dredgers.
This is so much different than other canoe clubs that are basically just founded to canoe. Ours has a purpose to clean.
In the 1970s, the Gowanus was called Lavender Lake, named for the thick layer of oil that floated on top of it. It was lined with industrial plants and used as a waterway to the New York Harbor and as a dumping ground for whatever the factories wanted to get rid of. That included a lot of toxic chemicals. The factories have mostly shut down now, but recent EPA testing found high levels of mercury, lead, cyanide, and asbestos still in the water. But Foote sees a better future for the canal. He imagines a clear stream of water filled with fish and waterfowl, a benefit to those who live around it rather than a conduit for filth, and a benefit also to New York Harbor. And he's got a plan for achieving that vision. It's a combination of trash pickups, public awareness, and political lobbying.
Can you get garbage with the oars?
No.
When I speak to Foote on the dock, he's coordinating a group of student volunteers. The students are out with rubber gloves and bags, picking up trash. It's a festive scene. There's music and free pizza. When the kids finish picking up the dock, Folk gives them a quick boating lesson, and they pile up the canoes.
All right, guys, it's three persons per boat. One person steers, one person...
Kovaleski says they want to teach the kids to value the water, to see its potential.
Just being here, being a presence, being visible to everybody in the area has made a huge difference, and it's brought a lot more people to the canal and a lot more people to recognize that this is an island city full of waterways and islands, and there's so much more potential for life in the city than, you know, shopping. And
when the kids get back, I ask 11-year-old Olivia Ford what she saw.
Well, I thought it was going to be cleaner, but there was a lot of trash inside the water as you got deeper. And they told us that they had oysters cleaning up the water. And we took a basket and cleaned out the oysters that were dead, found some shrimp.
Those oysters that she's talking about are another part of the dredger's work. The group stock the canal with bivalves, which clean the waters and also provide food for other animals. Kovaleski tells me she started to see the return of some wildlife that never could have survived in the canal before. Small fish, jellyfish, and waterfowl.
I'm always happy to see what is living here, what's surviving. I've seen cormorants, and I've seen a blue crane. And they're probably not the healthiest creatures, but I am excited that they're here and that they're surviving and they've found food and who knows what else they're ingesting. But, you know, we're all in it, so...
And there's one more part of their master plan. The dredgers want to access more federal funds for canal cleanup. And the Clean Water Act specifies that government has to give more money to clean up bodies of water that people actually use for recreation. So if lots of people start boating on the Gowanus, Foote thinks they can make a good case for more funding.
What the federal government looks at water bodies, they say, okay, well, is this water body being used? And how is it being used? Are people drinking it? Are people fishing in it? Are people canoeing in it? Are they swimming in it? And without somebody canoeing in it, they're not going to put as much money into cleaning it up. And so that's the main reason why we expose ourselves to a contaminated water body, is by that direct contact, that direct exposure, adds to the conditions that the federal government needs in order to allocate money towards this waterfront.
Kovaleski and Foote want me to see the water up close. So they load me into a canoe with a well-dressed fashion photographer from Brooklyn, Marco Dashev. He's never been out on a canal before.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you.
We paddle off towards New York Harbor. Marco describes what we're passing.
Well, there's a lot of industrial structures and some gravel pits, some rusted out junkyards, a parking lot, and in the distance you can see the Kentile Floors sign.
The city uses the Gowanus as a storm sewer, so whenever it rains, untreated wastewater floods into the canal. Kovaleski told me recent tests actually found gonorrhea in a Gowanus water sample, though she says she's been tested and was given a clean bill of health. Marco and I pass under an overpass. There are people fishing off the side. They bring home the striped bass and the bluefish they pull out of the canal, even though it can be toxic, and officials suggest limiting how often people eat it.
It's probably my friend. Klein. Yeah, I'm coming around the bend, actually. I'm going to meet up with you in a few minutes. Yeah. All right,
we head back to the dock and meet up with Dashev's friends, Stephen Klein and Beatrice Aranow. They've also been out on the water.
Okay, come on, it's my pants.
It's essentially treated as an open sewer. It's awful. It's a tragedy.
They were like dead rats, turds. It was really
but there was a beautiful bird on
there. There was a really beautiful bird on there with like bright green eyes. But
yeah, but it was a lot worse than I could have ever imagined.
Yeah, it was repulsive.
This doesn't really sound like a ringing endorsement of the dredgers. And, in fact, when I ask Klein and Aranow if they'll be back, they say, absolutely not. But Alex Kovaleski says this reaction isn't bad. It's actually kind of the point.
Part of it is just being in there with the poop and the trash, like, ha, here it is. You know, there's no getting away from it. Because we all do want places to go. We want the rivers to be clean. We want to feel like our backyard is beautiful. And if we can engender genuine interest in dealing with some of the practical issues of sustainable development, that's great.
For Making Contact, I'm Samara Freemark, New York.
The Hudson River runs 315 miles through eastern New York. It starts high in the Adirondack Mountains and on its way to New York Harbor. This grand river flows past steep cliffs, green rolling hills, sandy beaches, and thousands of parks. To many, it's one of the most impressive rivers in the world. But unfortunately, it's also been one of the most polluted. The Hudson River is the site where one of the largest freshwater environmental cleanups in U.S. history is underway. 30 years ago, General Electric dumped tons of toxic waste into the river. Now GE's trying to clean up its act by dredging a 40-mile stretch of the river to remove the waste. But as correspondent Amber Cortez reports, in the process, GE has muddied the water between those who want the dredging and those who don't.
You couldn't ask for a more perfect Saturday. The sun is shining and it's hot. People are swimming, families are barbecuing, and the Hudson River beckons with refreshing, cool water. New York City feels like it's a million miles away, even though the beach here at Croton Point Park is only about an hour from the city by train.
We love coming down here. I come down here for sunsets, we come down here for swimming. I just love it. I love the river. And every year there gets more and more people here. It gets livelier and livelier.
Bonnie Smith and her husband camp here every summer. They swim, relax, watch the boats go by, and fish. But if they catch any, they always throw the fish back.
I wouldn't want to eat fish that came out of this river right now. Because there are parts of the river that they're dredging upriver for PCBs. And who knows where, you know, the fish have been.
Bonnie has reason to worry. All the commercial fisheries here have closed long ago, and people are advised not to eat the fish. Because for 30 years, General Electric dumped more than a million pounds of toxic waste into the Hudson from its facility in Fort Edwards.
As a result of General Electric's PCBs, the entire Hudson River from Fort Edward down to New York Harbor is a federal Superfund site, meaning it's on the list of heavily contaminated sites around the country.
That's Alex Matheson, the president of Riverkeeper, Inc., an environmental organization that first blew the whistle on GE PCB contamination in the 70s. 3 decades later, and after a review from the EPA, General Electric is only now obligated to clean it up. But it wasn't easy.
General Electric, in the process, fought tooth and nail to avoid that cleanup, and it spent well over $100 million on lawyers and lobbyists and fancy public relations campaigns, propagandist campaigns, really. They were very dishonest and misleading in trying to gain public support for avoiding the cleanup. They had a whole campaign saying, you know, let Mother Nature solve the problem. These PCBs tend to bury themselves in the river bottom, in the sediment.
Print, radio, and television ads showed dirty clamshell dredges lifting sediment into heavy industrialized equipment. The ads, Matheson says, were misleading.
I have never met a single person, literally in my 9 years of running the organization, I don't care how well educated, how progressive, how environmentally conscious, who hasn't said to me at the first mention of GE and their PCBs, isn't it better just to leave them in the river? So it was a very, very effective campaign.
And as for Mother Nature?
The EPA, after 11-year, heavily peer-reviewed study, determined that, in fact, that's not true. The PCBs do settle on the bottom of the river, but they regularly get stirred back up from fish feeding, from storms, currents, rain events, etc.
But the controversy of dredging still remains, and there are some people who disagree.
My name is Sharon Ruggi, and I am a longtime member of CEES, the environmental organization here in the town of Fort Edward that has fought the dredging of the Hudson River for 30 years now.
Miss Ruggi lives about a quarter mile away from the dewatering facility, so to her, the fight against dredging is personal.
The Hudson River was a beautiful river. Mother Nature was doing a fantastic job of cleaning itself. And truly to see this heavy equipment in the river, riling it up, digging into the banks, it's very, very sad to see.
Members of CEES, or Citizen Environmentalists Against Sludge Encapsulation, are concerned that dredging is causing the resuspension of PCBs from the sediment into the water. And then there's the dredge site itself.
There is absolutely no hydraulic dredging being used. It is all the very old clamshell type. They put the bucket into the river, and when it comes up, there's very dirty water just flowing back into the Hudson River.
Now that the dredging is taking place, both groups are monitoring the General Electric cleanup, but they have vastly different takes on how it's going.
We are privy to regular information on status reports on the cleanup, and so far, for the most part, the cleanup has been going very well.
The cleanup is going very, very poorly because the air quality standards the EPA set themselves are being exceeded often.
The thing is, GE has only committed to the first phase of this project and can opt out of phase two, which is 90% of the actual dredging. Like GE, Cease has fought for a long time against the dredging and now wants the project to end. Since they're on the same side so often, I asked Sharon if the two ever joined forces.
We honestly have no relationship with General Electric. Perhaps it was at times difficult to see the distinction between their stand and ours. We were certainly both opposed to the dredging, but our concern was for our community, for our residents.
But a 2001 report written by Charlie Cray for the Multinational Monitor says otherwise. Cray writes for publications like The Nation and for Huffington Post. He's also director of the Center for Corporate Policy in Washington, D.C. In his report, Cray writes that Cease President Tim Havens said GE has supplied Cease with rally signs, bumper stickers, and other supporting studies.
Has Cease received any support from General Electric for its anti-dredging position in the past?
Not a penny. We have never received a penny from General Electric. We would not have asked for any money. That would certainly have diluted our message.
And have you received any other types of support from General Electric?
No. We have received no support from General Electric at all.
In the past and in the present?
Not in the past and not in the present.
When reached for comment, Cease Treasurer Jane Haven says the organization has never been paid to represent GE, but has appeared in GE infomercials against the dredging. As environmental groups along the Hudson continue to disagree and the dredging continues through phase one, one thing seems clear. No matter what happens, people will continue to come here to enjoy the river. And who wouldn't? This place is beautiful, and the swimming, perfect. Just don't eat the fish. For Making Contact, I'm Amber Cortez, along the banks of the Hudson River, New York.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to Tapped Out, Clean Water in Peril. Fresh water is a fundamental human right. The entire ecosystem depends on it for survival. Yet heated disputes continue around the world over who controls freshwater resources, who has access to it, and what defines a sensible allocation of it. Right now in the U.S., a nearly 20-year water war between Alabama, Florida, and Georgia has flared up again. At issue, water use rights to the Chattahoochee River and a reservoir on that waterway called Lake Lanier, part of a three-river system the state share. Florida and Alabama want Georgia to release more water downstream. Georgia says that would threaten Metro Atlanta's water supply. After a recent federal mandate, it looks like Florida and Alabama may get their way. But as correspondent Margie Menzel explains, the ruling could come too late for generations of Florida Panhandle residents who rely on the disputed waters for their living and their way of life. She reports from Tallahassee and Apalachicola.
see some small oysters that would knock off of it. That's a new crop coming. We try to save those.
Johnny Richards, a fifth-generation oyster man, deftly maneuvers his tongs, forming an iron basket on wooden poles, and hauls up a dripping load. At 68, he works a full week for himself, which he loves. The beds are rotated and replanted, the shells dumped back into Apalachicola Bay for the new oysters to fasten and grow.
This boat is like a tractor is to a farmer to us.
Richards keeps less than 5% of what he brings up. He throws the small ones back.
A lot of the oystermen don't do that, though. They just go ahead and put it in because there's more weight. They're sold by weight. They're 60 pounds per bushel. They don't really care about tomorrow. They just want to get it today and to heck with tomorrow.
Normally, Apalachicola Bay is a perfect incubator for seafood. Its mix of high and low water, fresh and salt water, supports a $200 million per year industry, drawing tourists from around the world. But the past 3 years of drought in the southeastern U.S. have taken their toll on these all-important waters. Kevin Bigos of the Franklin County Oyster and Seafood Industry Task Force.
The white shrimp harvest a couple of years ago dropped by almost 90%. Blue crabs were down 50 to 60%. There are always some fluctuations, but that 90% drop in shrimp was just enormous and almost unprecedented.
Generations have relied upon the bay to make a living. Supporting and protecting the flow of fresh water down the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint, or ACF, river system is the key to their industry's survival. But with Atlanta's growth exploding, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has kept more water in Lake Sidney Lanier in North Georgia for the metro area. And less fresh water flowing downstream has meant more salt in the water, a threat to endangered species, and dried-up oyster beds. Franklin County Commissioner Smokey Parrish manages Buddy Ward Seafood & Sons.
It is all about the quality of water here in our bay, and the oysters are a key ingredient to that. They're a filter feeder, which helps to remove a lot of the contaminants that if we didn't have our oyster production here in Apalachicola Bay, those contaminants would settle in the bay and it would go by the wayside as a great number of other bays around this country have gone.
In order to keep the water pristine, there is little development in the area. An anomaly on Florida's coastline, says Apalachicola Bay Chamber of Commerce Director Anita Grove.
You've got to really tip your hat to the present commissioners, county commissioners, and the commissioners that have come before them for the last 50 years. They've said that, you know, seafood is our livelihood, and they exist with the bay rather than just consume it and then never put anything back.
What's protecting the bay is the Endangered Species Act. When the Corps dammed up the river system in the 1950s, it did so only for flood control, navigation, and power generation. Drinking water for Atlanta was never in the plan. This past July, U.S. District Judge Paul A. Magnuson conferred legal recognition of this fact. He gave Georgia 3 years to get congressional approval for continuing to take water from the reservoir or return water withdrawals to mid-70s levels, far less than Atlanta now needs. Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue vowed to, in his words, fight to the death.
Judge Magnuson ruled this, that Congress has to make its mind up over the usage of these federal reservoirs, whether the Corps has the authority to manage them or whether they need to micromanage them through rules and statutory changes at every change.
Perdue is currently lobbying Congress. He's expected to appeal Magnuson's ruling later this year and is exploring an 1859 ruling that could give Georgia more control of the Chattahoochee River. Noting that Georgia's water use has been under public scrutiny throughout the litigation, Perdue says he's ready to turn the microscope on Florida's conservation record. He offered Florida Governor Charlie Crist and Alabama Governor Bob Riley 40 possible dates to meet and discuss a water deal. Riley approved 19. No word yet from a seemingly always hard to pin down Crist.
I'm very proud of Florida's record, and I think Georgia's done great work, and all of the United States of America has done well, and we have a lot to be proud of with how we're dealing with environmental issues in this country, in this great state.
Florida officials note that their state has had water districts for decades, while Georgia put conservation measures in place only recently. Kevin Bigos of the Oyster and Seafood Industry Task Force says it's time for Georgia to develop a plan respecting its neighbors' needs.
If Georgia started to negotiate more in good faith and put some concrete steps on the table, here's what we're doing with conservation, here's what we're doing with new water supplies, then it would be easier to negotiate. But it can't be a one-way negotiation where they just expect us to make all the sacrifices.
And Bigos isn't alone in questioning water officials. In his recent ruling, Judge Magnuson chastised state and local governments for the lack of a meaningful water use plan. Citing the problems that continue to brew among the three states, he is assured that this is a struggle others across the U.S. will face as available water resources continue to shrink. In Apalachicola, the good news is that recent rains are helping to restore the bay, but few are taking it for granted, and they aren't waiting for Governor Perdue. Dan Tonsmeyer of Apalachicola Riverkeeper belongs to an ACF stakeholders group with people from Georgia and Alabama. He says they all have one thing in common. They're all downriver.
You know, maybe you're downstream from farms, maybe you're downstream from Atlanta, you know, maybe you're downstream from everybody, but it's there's a common thread there that you understand that we're sharing this water. It's not ours or theirs.
Oyster man Johnny Richards is looking still further ahead.
Without the fresh water, our bay will be completely destroyed and it will be nothing but a tourist town. And we can't stand any more tourist towns. We need a food-producing people to feed the population that is growing so tremendously right now. So without the food-producing people, how would we survive?
The fear in Apalachicola Bay is that there won't be an agreement in place before the next drought. For Making Contact, I'm Margie Menzel, Florida.
Droughts are nothing new for states in the western U.S. Folks in California, Texas, and Arizona have their share of water rationing and enforced conservation measures. Yet lately, it's not just the West or Southwest that have experienced drought conditions. Over the past 3 years, the Southeast has been hit hard. States like Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida are unusually parched. But most people don't need an authority to tell them there are water shortages. Take the town of Orme, Tennessee, just across the northeastern Alabama border. The town literally ran out of water a few years ago. And as correspondent John Sepulveda reports, the residents say it's a sign of bigger water problems to come for the region.
The way to picture Orme is think ghost town at the end of a long dirt road in the Appalachian foothills. Then add 30 or so houses, a couple double-wide trailers, and a rickety old town hall. That's Orme. And the 100 or so residents, most of them, they're like this guy.
Tony Reams, mayor of Orme, Tennessee.
Tony Reams is about 50-ish, and he grows corn, raises chickens, and oh yeah, when his town spring ran dry, it was Tony's job to play the part of Jack and go fetch a pail of water. Except he didn't use a pail, but rather an old fire truck. And the part of Jill, well, that was played by a rotating cast of men older than Tony.
At the time, I was on all kinds of medication, and everybody that was hauling the water was over 65, so you'd imagine, you know, four or five old men up there trying to keep water. You know, we was hauling right out a million gallon a month. We ended up with about 4.5 million gallon of water we hauled in a 1967 bar truck that eventually it blowed up on us, so... You know, it was after we got the water in, but that was the cause of it. I mean, we put a lot of miles on that truck, just back and forth, a lot of strain going up the mountain. A lot of people griping because they didn't have water, you know, we was doing all we could do.
Essentially, during the good days, the spring supplied about 60,000 gallons to the town of Orme. Then the drought happened. And while the ground was drying up, building in the form of vacation homes and sprawl homes from Chattanooga, they kept popping up around the area.
You had a lot of development up here on the mountains that took away groundwater from us. They cut all the trees. You know, that takes... I mean, your groundwater don't stay. It just runs off.
The water started receding until about 5,000 gallons, or the average amount of water used each day by 26 South Florida residents, came up from the spring. The short of it is that's just not enough water to pressurize the lines. Tony knew the water was running out. In fact, everybody in Orm did. But as government often works, nothing could be done to help or finance a new water supply until the taps went dry. So Tony and his band of water brothers filled up the old 1967 fire truck with water and brought it into town. This was back in 2007, and if you wanted to take a bath during this time or wash some dishes, you had to wait until 6 p.m. each evening. That's when the guys turned the water on. Yancey Payne lives in Orm, and she says during these hours, everyone was inside.
They let the water run so often, ever so often, you know, and they would try to catch the time, you know, where they could use the water.
You know, they'd cuss and go on and just about give up on it, you know. And then, you know, you had to kind of, you know, satisfy them. And it was rough.
It was hard on all these people not having water, you know, just certain hours, certain days, they'd turn it on or whatever. So it was rough on them.
Eventually, Orm got about $400,000 in grant money from federal and state agencies. Tony and his town were able to build new pipes with that money that send water in from Alabama. The irony in all this is that Orm is right down the road from the Tennessee River, but because of the topography, piping the water in from the river was almost impossible. The Tennessee is, of course, a huge drinking water source in the southeast. The other irony in all this is that several other mountain towns near the Tennessee River, they also went dry for the same reasons.
Mont Eagle, Tennessee ran out. They even had their welcome centers closed up there due to lack of water. There were several towns right here run out. Like I said, Carpenter Cove, they ran out. Their springs went dry. And still, as you drive down the creek and down the road, you look at these creeks, they're not up to par. They're right down low. Even though all the rain we had, they should be full bank. You know, they're not. They're just, you know, they're down to nothing. So that just tells you how really far we are behind. We think we're in good shape. We got plenty of top ground water, but your low ground, underground water's low.
Now, when all this was happening, Reams started studying water problems throughout the South. He wanted to make sure his town was never unprepared again. And this mayor of a tiny town barely anyone has heard of, well, he came to the same conclusions that researchers and scientists and academics that get paid to study water issues found in paper after paper and study after study.
They don't need to take the good times for granted. They need to keep working on the water problems throughout the South, and that situation could be right back here on us.
Many experts agree with Tony Reams. Joe Cook is the head of the Coosa Basin River Initiative. His job is to monitor water issues in the Southeast, and he says Tony's on target.
Well, I think that there's certainly that Orm is kind of could be considered a microcosm of what's taking place.
On a macro level, Georgia is a lot like Orm. There are no large aquifers near Georgia's population centers.
A city the size of Atlanta would be much better suited in a place like Savannah or Columbus or Augusta or Rome, where there's lots of water to meet the needs. Because Atlanta is at the very headwaters of a small river, and it's a really, really bad place to have 4 million people living.
For Making Contact, I'm John Sepulveda, Orm, Tennessee.
For decades, water experts and environmentalists warned that rapid population growth, poor resource planning, and suburban sprawl have come at a cost to our water supplies. In several regions across the U.S., water shortages, increased pollution, and heated battles over water resources are the norm. And as the Environment Report's Rebecca Williams explains, we need to change our ways, and quickly.
Even in swampy, muggy Florida, people have been running out of water.
This is the first time the well has ever gone dry.
Ellen Peterson can remember water gushing out of her artesian well when she'd hook up the hose. These days, she's stuck with rusty water from her shallow well.
Now, if I let that sit, it would settle out orange.
We visited Peterson at the tail end of this year's dry season. In the weeks since then, Florida has been pummeled by major thunderstorms. But Florida water managers say it's too early to know how much the rain will help. This was the driest dry season Florida's felt in more than 75 years. and it's the third year in a row of serious drought. That's meant some changes for people who live here. A lot of cities have put rules in place that limit watering lawns to 1 or 2 days a week. One woman actually ended up with a warrant out for her arrest after she watered her lawn on the wrong day and didn't pay the fine. Some cities in Florida are talking about adding a drought surcharge to bills for people using the most water. Ellen Peterson says local water managers have even been capping wells. Peterson may be 85 years old, but that didn't stop her from telling her local official to back off.
They told me that they were going to come cap my well, and I threatened the guy with his life if he ever came back. So it didn't happen yet. Hasn't happened yet.
So it's not such an easy sell to get people to cut back on water. But that's Gary Ritter's job. He's a water manager in the Lake Okeechobee area. It's a giant lake, 35 miles wide, and it's nicknamed the Liquid Heart of the Everglades. The lake level is 2.5 feet below average.
For water to get to the Everglades, it has to come from Lake Okeechobee. Now we have a juggling act as to how we manage this water in the system, for the multiple users, for the water supply, and for the ecosystem.
The lake's the center of a huge tug of war. Farmers and cities need the water, and the lake's also a big tourist draw. And the Everglades are in major trouble, mostly because the water flow to this fragile area has been cut off by people. Some experts say these kinds of conflicts are just going to get worse. Peter Glick is president of the Pacific Institute. It's a nonpartisan group that studies water issues.
Places that we didn't think were vulnerable to water shortages in the past are now increasingly vulnerable as our population continues to grow and our water supply doesn't. As more and more people try to share that fixed resource, there's going to be growing competition for water and more both natural and man-made drought.
And he says we just don't know what's in store for us as the climate changes because of global warming. We could get a 1-2 punch. First, from weird new weather patterns causing surprise droughts. And second, from more and more people moving into dry areas. People have expected these kinds of problems for cities in the desert Southwest, but nobody really saw this coming in the Southeast. Peter Glick says even if you live in a place surrounded by water now, you shouldn't expect to always have plenty of it.
That was Rebecca Williams with the Environment Report. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. The U.S. Government Accountability Office reports that at least 36 states can expect to face water shortages within the next 5 years. Hundreds of organizations across the country are working to prevent that from happening. Clean Water Action is one of them. For more than 35 years, through grassroots organizing, policy research, and political advocacy, Clean Water Action has continued the work of protecting our fresh waterways. Making Contact's Andrew Stelzer spoke to Program Associate Jennifer Clary at her office in San Francisco.
Jennifer, we've grown accustomed to hearing stories about drought in the western United States, but over the past few years we're seeing droughts and even so-called water wars in the southeastern United States and other parts of the country. Is this something we can expect to see more of?
I think so. Well, the one thing we know about global warming is we'll have more extremes, so we'll have more extreme wet weather and more extreme dry weather. So more dry weather means more droughts.
And you mentioned global warming. That's a reason we've been hearing for several years. But there are also the other factors that are more directly related to human water management, such as urban sprawl and unwise allocation of water for farming. Which of these reasons is playing a greater role in current and future water shortages?
The way we use water in the United States is incredibly wasteful. and changing the way we use water can go a long way towards resolving some of these conflicts.
And how can we do that?
Well, I think you start by thinking about where you live and matching your water use to where you live. So, for instance, if you live in the Southwest, you should have climate-appropriate landscaping because half the water use in a home is landscaping. If you have climate-appropriate landscaping, you're not going to be sucking up water like you would if you have a beautiful lawn like a Scotland golf course.
And now there's the question of having enough water, but there's also the question of whether that water is drinkable. And recently on September 12th, the New York Times published an article about the lack of proper regulation on the part of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and also state agencies. The article found violations of the Clean Water Act are routine across the country, that enforcement of regulations has been shoddy, fines for polluters are rare and often insufficient to cause the polluter to stop. The article paints a really bleak picture of how our clean water is regulated. It says more than 500,000 violations over the past few years, and the offenders are rarely punished. What's your overall feeling? Why is this happening?
Well, I think it's just a very labor-intensive thing to do to regulate water quality because water sucks up everything. So it's so ubiquitous that it's difficult for the agencies to keep up. And I also think that you tend to get these relationships between the regulated community and the regulator. And so they don't get to know the public that's being impacted by water quality. They get to know the people that they're regulating. And sometimes the people are having hard times and you want to give them a break. And they don't, I think sometimes they're not thinking of the final impact to human health. So I think there's two things, resources and maybe too cozy a relationship.
And in this article, several local and state regulators defend themselves by saying that our water is cleaner than it was in 1972 when the Clean Water Act was passed. Assuming this is true, what should our response be as a society to that claim?
Well, it's nice that our water is cleaner than it was 36 years ago when rivers were lit on fire because of the toxics in them. But the fact is our progress stopped about 10 years ago, and we've been steady or declining water quality since. And I don't think you stop. We know that we have severe water quality problems. So why would you say that the fact that we're better means that we're good enough?
In one passage from this article in the New York Times, a West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection head points out that state regulators fined mining companies about $15 million since 2006. But then the article points out that $15 million is roughly equal to the revenue those businesses' parent companies collect every 10 hours. These mining operations and other large-scale industries, which are often the biggest polluters, these are multi-million-dollar, sometimes billion-dollar companies. Even if fines were levied on them, how high would the fines have to be to impact their bottom line and make them change? It seems like those fines are basically just the cost of doing business.
Exactly. I mean, if it's just a cost, it's just a line item. You have to do something that hurts. You either have to make the fines big or you have to tell them they can't do it. And if you tell them they just can't have that discharge, then it starts to hurt. And, of course, then they go to Congress and try to change the laws, which they do pretty regularly.
And then what about the PR battle? Earlier in our program, we heard a story about a cleanup of the Hudson River by GE and how they managed to convince many of the residents of the area that dredging the river to remove PCBs was a bad thing. That example is a subject of controversy, so we don't have to get into that specifically. But I'm wondering, in your advocacy work here at Clean Water Action, does the public in general understand the extent to which their drinking water and other freshwater bodies are polluted? What kind of messaging is coming from the polluters, and is their messaging working?
I think the one thing that we see with everyone we talk to is that they really are concerned about water quality and they care about water quality. And even though these big polluters have a huge amount of money they can spend on PR, I haven't seen that they're convincing the public that they're doing the right thing. I really think that the public is smarter than that.
And I'm also wondering, are there any states or state agencies or even local agencies which are doing an exceptionally good job of water management, places we can look to for solutions?
Well, you know, the Southern California Regional Water Quality Control Board is one of the better regulating agencies, at least in the state of California. And they do a very good job of, you know, not perfect because there's so much to do, but they do a very good job of regulating things. In terms of water management, I think what you're looking for is an agency that's really looking to branch out and try a lot of different things. So different ways of treating their wastewater, and that could be something like Orange County that's recycling all their wastewater and recharging groundwater supplies with it. Or you can have, San Francisco is working on a gray water program. East Bay Mud has a rule where new developments have to offset their new water use so that they're water neutral. So a lot of water agencies are doing different things, and all of them can do more, and a lot of them are really pushing the envelope.
Now, almost a year into the new Obama administration, have things changed since President Bush? What can you say about President Obama's intentions on water policy, and is he keeping his promises made during the campaign?
I think that we're all hopeful that things were so bad under the Bush administration that they can only get better. Already we've seen that the EPA pull back on some of the really bad rulings that were jeopardizing water quality. So I think initially it's good, and we're waiting to see them implement. They've pulled back some of the bad rulings. We're waiting for them to implement some good rulings.
What are some of those?
One would be how they're going to enforce the Clean Water Act. As you know, there's been a lot of conflict over that, and we've had legislation that hasn't made it through yet to correct the problems created by the judiciary. And then another thing would be regulations on contaminants. You know, some contaminants like perchlorate still don't have a drinking water standard. So we haven't had new drinking water standards for several years, and there's a lot of contaminants. There's cleanup programs and strengthening those cleanup programs.
That was Making Contact's Andrew Stelzer speaking with Jennifer Clary of Clean Water Action. Throughout the show, we've talked about the impact of water shortages, water rights, and water pollution. But what about the health effects of the food you eat that comes from the water? Scientists have known for a long time that a large portion of wild-caught fish contains dangerous contaminants. So people who eat fish have to weigh the health benefits against the risks of consuming those pollutants. But now some research could make that balancing act even trickier. Our final segment, produced by the Environment Report's Gabriel Spitzer, has more on the link between diabetes and an infamous old chemical thought to be long gone.
In the early morning hours, anglers gather on Navy Pier in downtown Chicago. Ray Penn is practically within casting distance of the city's skyscrapers. He dips his line in the waters of Lake Michigan, hoping to pull out something tasty.
I feel I am in the prime, yeah. They got a little bit of bones in them, but Oh, yeah, baby. I felt that.
It's looking like a good morning for rock bass.
See, there's a bass on the end of this. This is a small bass. I'm going to want to know. This guy here, he's edible.
Penn says he eats fish a couple of times a week without giving it a second thought. Down the pier, Patrick Duhan has the same attitude.
This is the Great Lakes. It's such a big body of water. It's almost like the ocean. They throw tons of crap in the ocean, and there's just too much of it to screw up.
But scientists say people have managed to screw up the Great Lakes a fair amount. Epidemiologists have been studying a group of sport fishers like these guys and charter boat captains who eat a lot of Great Lakes fish. Mary Turek of the University of Illinois at Chicago measured the contaminants in their blood and tracked their health over the years.
We found we had 36 cases of new diabetes. And what we found was that DDE, the metabolite of DDT, was related to diabetes incidence.
DDT, that's the pesticide made infamous by Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring. The chemical was banned in 1972, but traces of it are still all over the place, including in fish. And like mercury or PCBs, it concentrates as it moves up the food chain. so you don't have to eat much.
The captains were eating, I think, on average, a meal a week.
One meal a week?
Yeah.
That doesn't seem outlandish or anything.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't at all. And in fact, recommendations from the FDA for eating fish based on mercury levels are 2 meals per week for pregnant women.
So just half that much fish was linked to about a 33% increase in diabetes cases. Turek says it's not clear how DDE or DDT might contribute to diabetes. It might have to do with effects on hormones or the immune system.
We really need to have more basic science to determine mechanisms that might be responsible for this.
Another unknown is just how dangerous this might be, and when does it start to outweigh the advantages of eating an otherwise healthy food? Tamara Duperval is a family doctor at a Westside Chicago clinic. She says she still tells people to eat more fish.
In our population, it's a great wonder and a challenge to try to present fish as an option when primarily the staple of diet is either chicken or beef.
That population is mostly low income and minority. She says about half are overweight or obese. From a nutrition point of view, those are exactly the people you'd want to be eating a lean, healthy protein like fish. So Duperval is concerned about sending mixed messages.
I do think it is confusing, and it's in part, I think, how we communicate crisis in our country, especially when it comes to food safety. They miss the overall preventive message that fish is good food, and it actually provides a lot of important nutrients that are lacking in their diets.
Health authorities often issue advisories about certain fish that have a lot of pollution. Duperval says understanding those warnings can help people avoid some of the hazards. But the diabetes research shows we may still have a lot to learn about these chemicals. So what's safe to eat is getting harder to know.
That was Gabriel Spitzer with the Environment Report. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. This special one-hour Making Contact program is made possible in part by the Park Foundation. The Living with Less Water segment by Rebecca Williams and the Great Lakes Fish Linked to Diabetes segment comes from the Environment Report, which receives its funding from the Park Foundation and the Joyce Foundation. To learn more about the Environment Report, log on to our website at radioproject.org. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast Crew. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer producer, Pauline Bartoloni online editor and producer, ConFam associate director, Megan Martini our media consortium intern, and Rita Daniels and Lakeisha Thomas interns. And I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact. Bye.